Hi guys, welcome back to a special multi-parter for Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. So I'm recording this at 6 a.m. on Easter Saturday. So for those of you who celebrate Easter, happy Easter to you. And I hope you're enjoying like a long weekend like you should. But if you're working, I hope you're getting double rates. So I decided to drop you an extra episode this week because I want to get started on this series that I've been researching for probably 6 months without knowing I'd be doing it on the podcast. But if you don't kind of enjoy this kind of biography, because I've done one on Julian Assange before, I've done one on Heath Ledger before, this is probably my first political one, maybe my last, because as much as I've studied these kinds of things, especially with Russia and the Russian Revolution when I was in school, I find it very complicated, politics and how it is all set up. But doing Alexei's story, I think I'm following kind of, you know, the heart of the matter, which is this is a human being and I have followed his story for ages. Now, I just want to say before I get into this week's episode or part one of it, I want to say that thank you to Mary Bell and Terry, who told me, sent me a message and said that on the previous episode where we did Casey and Caleb's deaths in Anguilla, I said that a nurse practitioner, because I don't think we have that in Australia, I said it was probably a nurse and I was wrong. They told me that a nurse practitioner is actually like a really highly skilled nurse that can actually diagnose people and also prescribe medications. And I didn't know that. So that may change how you feel about Casey and Caleb's story. And it probably does for me. So thank you so much. So yeah, let me know what your feedback is on each episode via email, unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com or on Patreon, because that's where our community is, because I'm not on Instagram. So I want to say quickly, I'm recording this on my phone because I'm having issues with my microphone. It cost me like over $100 a few months ago and it's giving me the shits. It's got like an issue with the cord and that's why there's weird kind of sound in the background and I didn't want that to happen for this one. My cat Cinnamon is rubbing against my leg even though I've given her breakfast. She's been all smoochy. Now, I want to say that I will be playing a few excerpts for interviews on this multi-parter about Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader in Russia who's currently in a Russian penal colony. And each week there's more and more news coming out about him because if any of you have followed his story since August last year where he was poisoned with a nerve agent, you will know that he is now sentenced, which I'll get into probably on part three, to almost 3 years in a Russian, essentially like, it's almost like a concentration camp. They call it a penal colony there. Now, I really wanted to do this, and I guess a few of you are wondering how it fits into the podcast theme. Well, I'm just saying that because Alexei was taken to Germany, and that's a major part of his story, where he was recovering from being poisoned with the Novichok nerve agent, and then he has returned to Russia and then been put in prison, which is totally unjust. I know a lot of you have followed his story, and one particular person, when I talked about Alexei on a previous episode, said thank you for mentioning him because it kind of gets lost in the Western world news. He just becomes like a byline where people are doing kind of updates on him, but I'm regularly checking in for updates. And on my private Instagram, I follow his wife and his daughter, and that's kind of where people are getting the majority of their updates about his well-being at the moment. So I'll be going through his story, how he came to kind of rise to power as the Russian opposition leader, and how him and Vladimir Putin is really kind of crushing him. And we'll be talking about Russia, the history of Russia, which is really interesting to me. In year 12 in Australia, when you do history, which I did, one of your units is the Russian Revolution, which is one of my favorite things I've ever studied in school. And I always remembered it. And so my friend Mark, who has been on a previous episode, he has been to Russia. He loves Russia. He's got the coolest souvenirs from there, which I'll probably talk about at some point. I had him over the other day to kind of brush up my memory of the Cold War, the Russian Revolution, Stalin. So I'm going to give you a very brief, and I mean brief, kind of lead into when Alexei Navalny was born and what he was born into in Russia, what the culture there was at the time. So Mark took me through all of this stuff, a few things we didn't know, we looked up together. He has showed me photos of when he's been in Russia. As I said, he's got really cool souvenirs, even though he thinks that one day if he puts them up, someone might arrest him because they might think he's a communist, but he's not. He's just got these cool souvenirs. And it's always been something that's really interested me, the Tsar, the Russian Revolution, through Stalin, the Cold War, Lenin, and to now, basically. So I hope that you'll learn something from this about at least Russia or Navalny or how their political movement works, and maybe you'll start following his story as well. Now, the interviews in this multi-parter, which I think will be three parts, I'm going to, take it slow. And I'm sorry if that doesn't interest you, but maybe just skip forward like a couple of weeks until we'll have more, you know, regular stories that we'll be doing. But I like to do these bios once in a while. The interviews for this will be limited because there's very few in English, and English is my language. So I'll be including, English interviews in this. I'm sorry, I know there are Russian interviews, but because I can't understand them, I'm English speaking and most of my listeners are, I will only be including him speaking English, and there's very few of them. As much as I've followed him online and I watch his Russian things with subtitles, I don't want to include them in this because as much as I do have followers in Russia, actually, I've been in like the top 50 for a few weeks in Russia. So that's another reason that I want to do this, to thank people who listen in Russia. And hello, and we care about you. And if you're a fan of Navalny and you're anti-Putin, I am thinking of you. And I think you're very, you know, brave if you've been out there protesting and things like that. But there's very few English-speaking interviews with Navalny. He's been on 60 Minutes a couple of times in the States, as with most Europeans, because they're so cool and classy, most of them, and educated. He does speak English, so I'll be including those. Now, I'm going to start with some history of Russia, the Soviet Union for a while, as it was known, or the USSR, so we know how Alexei Navalny came to be and what he was born into. And as I said, I love Russian history, as does my friend Mark. So we have talked at length for about 3 years about these kinds of things. And I want to give a shout out to him for brushing up my knowledge on these things. I would have him on this podcast, and Mark never gets sick, but he's very sick at the moment, and he lives next door to me. So thoughts to Mark, even though he doesn't listen to the podcast. So let's get into Russia. Now, Russia is a country that's been hidden behind the Iron Curtain. It has seen revolution, upheaval, bloodshed, much in the last century. Oh, I want to say quickly that this is a podcast, a Patreon recommendation. I don't know why I didn't say it earlier. When you become a patron, you get to choose a location for an upcoming episode. And as I said last week, if people choose the same place, because I've got about 15 on my list now to do, we'll be combining people who choose the same place. And I hope you understand that. But it's just because I've added this option since I started this for patrons, where you get to choose a location. But I made that not thinking it would be very popular. And now I've got about 12, and I know you guys will understand that. So I'm doing Terry and Emily. One of their recommendations for both of them was Russia. I got a few Russia requests in the past. It really interests people. So I want to say this is for Terry and Emily. Now, as I said, Russia is a country that has been hidden behind the Iron Curtain for much of the last century. It has seen revolution, upheaval, and bloodshed, much of it in the last century. And I guess most people consider Russians some of the toughest. When I've been to Thailand and Cambodia, there are a lot of Russian tourists, and I always find them very, you know, intense people. But that's probably because, you know, their history before them, if you believe in like inherited trauma and things like that, is so much revolution and upheaval and turmoil and bloodshed. So let's go back about a century, just over a century, to 1918. And this is my jam because this is what I studied in school. I also studied the Cold War, but it didn't interest me as much as the Russian Revolution. So in 1918, centuries of imperial rule by the Tsars, which is T-S-A-R-S, some parts of the world C-Z-A-R-S, that comes to an end with the murder of the reigning Tsar, which was Nicholas II, his wife, and their five children. Now, many people will know this story because there's that, you know, bullshit about that woman who claimed to be one of the children, Anastasia. She came forward like decades later and said that she was Anastasia. She wasn't. And I'm sorry to tell you, but all of them were murdered. None of them survived because they have found their bones. And if you know anything about the Russian Revolution, you'll know that they were able to do like DNA tests and determine that bones they found really not that long ago belonged to the Tsar. The Tsar and his wife and their five children were taken out of power. They were taken into a room and they were massacred. They were basically bludgeoned to death at one point when they didn't die, but they were also shot. This was basically because of socialist demands from starving and freezing workers and really inappropriate behaviour from members of the Russian royal family. Many of you will understand and remember that Rasputin, I think his name was Gregory Rasputin. He was a mystic that came into the Russian royal family, much of it while Nicholas II was away at war. He actually served during the First World War. He manipulated Tsar Nicholas's second, like his wife, and he basically told her how to run, and it really just went to shit. He ended up just being a drunk, and it's an amazing story of how Rasputin was killed by people who wanted him out of the picture. And there's a ton of really good resources on that, but I'm not going to talk about that really. But ultimately, people were starving, especially people in rural areas, and there was a lot of calls. I'm not going to get into revolutions and things that happened or storming of any places that led to the abdication of Nicholas II in 1917. Now, I want to say something really funny that I've just been thinking about. Nicholas II, he looks like a hipster today. I want you to pause, look up Nicholas II, the Tsar of Russia. It is unbelievable. And I also saw a picture the other day because all of these royal families were interlinked and they were cousins of what is now the British royal family, who back then were known as the Saxe-Coburgs. But after the Second World War, they changed their name because they didn't want to sound like Nazis because they had one in their family. I saw a picture, which I will try to find because I don't know if I have it anymore, and I'll put it online, of just how strong these genetic links between these families were, because Nicholas and I think it was a picture of the Queen's grandfather, they weren't identical in these pictures. Now, if you want to know why the Brits didn't help the Tsar and his wife get out of Russia before they were murdered by pretty much the opposition, you'll have to kind of look that up. But basically, they couldn't or they wouldn't, and I'm not really sure. Now, the monarchy of Russia was then abolished and a provisional government was formed. And these were all things that during my Russian history classes in year 12, I remember studying very late and trying to understand all of these things and the provisional, you know, leader of Russia, Kerensky, and all of these things. So reading all this really took me back and it gave me heart palpitations because I did one of my final high school's exams on this very subject, so it's given me anxiety. Now, former exiled prisoner and Bolshevik, a man called Vladimir Lenin, which many of you would know him, long story short, he takes control, forming a Soviet government of Leninism. So the city of St. Petersburg was named Leningrad, Stalingrad, Petrograd. It has been through so many different names, and so has Leninism, Stalinism, all of these different things. Now, as Mark reminded me to put in this when I was reading him this, the Red and White Armies have a civil war until 1921. And in 1921, the Reds win the civil war and Russia, long story short, becomes the USSR, which when I was in high school, and I want to say this because fuck them, I had like a funny thing where I couldn't read that out in the history class and everyone would like laugh at me, this pack of bitches in the corner of the room. I would say, you are the like I couldn't say it. And I used to like dread because my teacher used to get me to read things out loud. So I've been practicing saying that because I don't want anyone to laugh at me like those fucking moles. Now, in 1924, Vladimir Lenin died. So it wasn't very long after that. And you can actually visit his body, as has Mark, in the Kremlin in Moscow. I saw a very good article recently about how they maintain Vladimir Lenin's body because he's been dead for almost 100 years and how there's a team of like five people that actually maintain his body, which is really gross. They should probably just throw him out at this point. But there's a lot of people who still, you know, idolize Lenin, and there'd probably be a civil war if someone did that. A man called Joseph Stalin, who is looked back in history as one of the greatest dictators of all time, Idi Amin, who we've talked about on a previous episode, Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, they always are kind of discussed together. A young Joseph Stalin, who was really hot, look up a young Joseph Stalin. He was hailed as the successor of the leader of the Communist Party and ultimately of the Soviet Union. And the leadership of Russia at this point, or the USSR, was once collective. It was a number of people who worked together. But Stalin wasn't having that mustachioed fuck. And this led to a sole dictatorship under Stalin, which history will remember as Stalinism. Now, under Stalin, millions of people died. And people still, you know, in Russia look back at this time as one of the greatest times in Russian history, which, I mean, as we understand it in the West, that's just, you know, not the way it is. Stalin introduced collectivization, which is something I remember from year 12. And this was basically where people who lived in rural areas and the peasants, because the peasants weren't the ones that Stalin was looking after. He was really, as people look back on history, they consider him a champion of the working class. Peasants who were living and working on farms were basically forced to give up all of their produce that they reaped from their farms back that would go to the cities and to the working class, which led to millions of people dying, famines, and Stalin was also, which is a common theme in Russia, paranoid. Many in his Great Purge, as they call it, were imprisoned and executed, and he was very paranoid, which is usually what happens when people get too much power, as you'll remember from Idi Amin freaking out and doing drugs and having his own army, that kind of thing. Now, as Mark reminded me to put in, the Soviet Union expanded after World War II. It was pretty much the opposite of Western Europe and Eastern Europe, as you'll know with the Berlin Wall. Eastern Europe, if you were unfortunate enough for the wall to be put up and you be on the eastern side, that meant communism, and Western Europe meant democracy. So countries like Prague, that's not a country, Czech Republic, Hungary, as many of you who have traveled will know that you can go there now, and it's one of them, they're some of the most popular places in the world to go to. But back when my mum was traveling in the early 80s and my dad in the 70s, those were off limits. So Stalin ultimately died in 1953, which really left Russian split as to A, whether he was a champion of the working class, or B, a totalitarian monster. And the Western world really seems to see him as a totalitarian, but people who are still alive from that time in Russia, many of them look back and they respect him. And many of them today respect Putin, and it's really split. Now, as Mark reminded me to put in, the 60s and 70s introduced, you know, the Cold War, which was pretty much Russia or the USSR versus America, as we'll talk about in a little bit. Russians were really poked with propaganda and had it rammed down their throats. They were pretty much told that Americans were the worst in the world, which Alexei Navalny also was told. And I think it takes a really kind of strong person to understand that that's not what's happening. I often think of people in North Korea who try to escape, and I think they must be some of the most intelligent people, because despite all of this propaganda being rammed down their throats and the outside world is out to get them, they still try to escape because they know that what they're being told is a lie and whatever is out there is better than what's in here. So the 60s saw the space race, which was pretty much Russia versus the United States. Ultimately, the United States got to the moon first, which we all know, if you believe it. I don't know how I feel. Russia, if you don't believe it, one of the pieces of evidence which shows that man did land on the moon was the fact that Russia stopped trying to get to the moon after the US did it. And Russia would have intelligence that showed they didn't and would still be trying to show that to the world, but that didn't happen. Paranoia about communism and socialism leading into communism really creates a hubbub. The Vietnam War kicks off, which is pretty much a reaction to fear of communism, another thing I studied in school. It pretty much happened because they considered it, this is a shout out to Miss Cohen who was telling me all this stuff, they considered Australia was going to be hit with communism next because they considered it a domino effect where it would fall down to Indonesia under Vietnam and then it would hit Australia. So that's why Australia was so heavily involved in Vietnam as well. In Hollywood, which is one thing that I find really interesting, actors were considered, you know, potential communists and were put on a list. McCarthyism was in full swing, which was pretty much putting suspected communists on trial. And the tagline, Reds Under the Beds, a lot of movies at the time represented that. And I always remember that one of the actors that was always on these lists was Katharine Hepburn, that she was suspected of being, you know, a Red Under the Bed. Stalin was succeeded by a range of leaders. And in 1991, I just skipped over a lot of decades, but that's what's happening. The Soviet Union was ultimately dissolved, and in came, instead of leaders of the Communist Party, presidents, and I guess ushered in a form of capitalism. Now, this was a result of Mikhail Gorbachev's introduction of elections, multi-party systems, and various other reasons, but he was really the least communist leader. And he was also, from memory, the first Russian leader who met with a US president. I believe it was Nixon. People in Russia and the USSR, what was then the USSR, are split on Gorbachev. You will know Gorbachev. He was the one who had the birthmark on his head. And if you've watched the miniseries that came out a couple of years ago, Chernobyl, you'll recognize him represented in that. Honestly, if the guy didn't have a birthmark painted on his head, I would not know it was meant to be Gorbachev, because he looked nothing like him. But ultimately, in the December of 1991, I think it was on Christmas Day, Mikhail Gorbachev handed power to the very first president of Russia after this 100 years of the Tsar and his family and the monarchy being taken out, and then communism for so many decades, handed to Boris Yeltsin. Now, Boris Yeltsin was the dude who danced on stage, one of my earliest memories, and you guys may remember it as well, kind of a chubby guy who did the twist. Now, during this time, a baby named Alexei Anatolievich, I got this perfect earlier, and now Alexei Anatolievich Navalny would be born during the Cold War on June 4th, 1976. But it wouldn't be until he was 25 in 1991 that the Soviet Union would ultimately be abolished, and a president, Yeltsin, would be installed after Stalin's death. So he was born into a very strong, still Soviet Union. Now, Alexei was born into a strictly communist family where the USA was considered the enemy. Food rations were a common thing, especially in the later years when they were leading towards capitalism. And this often meant standing in line for hours. So here's Alexei Navalny a few years ago on US 60 Minutes talking about what he was born into in the Soviet Union.
Committed communist family in a small town south of Moscow.
What was your childhood like?
I'm 41 years old. It means that actually I'm a guy from the Soviet Union. Huh? I was a young pioneer. I had my red tie. My father was the military. And I was very proud that my father is guarding Mother Russia from evil Americans with their bombs and missiles. Actually, my biggest memory that I'm as a child, standing in line, maybe sometimes for hours to just buy milk.
Just 1 year before Alexei Navalny was born, the Vietnam War officially ended. And as many as 2 million civilians died during the Vietnam War. The rest were Viet Cong, who they were essentially fighting, American soldiers, Australian soldiers, and other countries that were involved as well. I think from memory, it was, 50,000 US soldiers and 500 Australians. And ultimately, it wasn't worth it because it didn't change anything and they didn't win. And North Vietnam is now considered communist. But the domino effect that they were worried about happening, you know, didn't happen. To this day, there is only five communist countries left in the world: Cuba, North Korea, North Vietnam. I honestly can't think right now. Now, before the abolition of the Soviet Union, childhood under the Soviet Union was full of propaganda, influencing from state-run media and brainwashing. And again, if you've watched, which is probably the only recent thing I can think of that a lot of people have watched, if you've watched Chernobyl, you'll understand how the Stasi work, the secret police, and how life was very grey under it. But again, that is not the memory of a lot of people, especially a lot of the older people who remember it and are still loyal, you know, patriots. Now, a woman wrote, she wrote for the Forbes magazine, which was a really good read. It was really long. Her name was, I think it's changed here. Her name's Katie Soldak. It's not Katie. It's like Katrin. It's further down. It's autocorrect has changed it. But she wrote this massive Forbes magazine that I've pulled from about her memories as a Soviet child in Soviet Ukraine, which is actually where Alexei Navalny's father was from, and where he spent a great majority of his childhood growing up, which was behind, the USSR. She wrote, quote, "The methods used by the Soviet propaganda machine to influence public opinion are still alive, thanks to the former KGB operative currently holding power in Russia." She's talking about Putin, "though often go unnoticed. It's worth looking back and reminiscing on how a population of roughly 300 million Soviet people lived for generations under communist rule and how the party cultivated loyalty among them. This is my account of what it was like to be a little communist in the Soviet Union as the USSR began to fall apart. When I permit myself to stroll through my maze of Soviet memories, I find it so multi-layered and infused with propaganda that it's difficult to find my way out again. Perhaps that's because for me and others born and raised behind the Iron Curtain, the USSR was not an evil empire or a mysterious communal utopia of sharing and equal rights. It was our home. We lived in small apartments in multi-generational families, wore school uniforms and red pioneer ties," which is what Navalny was talking about. "Our families gathered around dining tables over boiled potatoes, kielbasa, pickled tomatoes and cucumbers, and everyone did their best to enjoy themselves. We also repeated party lines like 'Little Patriots, proletarians of all countries unite, all power to the Soviets, peace to the people, land to the peasants.'" Unquote. Now, she wrote that around, she would have been around the age of Navalny when he was born, and was raised under quite a similar life, or very similar. And she wrote about the 80s, which was when Navalny would have been in his teenage years, being a time of stagnation, and how once loyal Communist Party members, like her parents, had lost faith in the party. Now, as I said, if you watch the series Chernobyl, which is amazing, and I've watched it twice, and I realised that a lot of people had issues with the British accents in it, but that's only because if you watch the creator speak about it, he said that there was actors from all over the world, and he thought that it would be almost comedic if they were doing these fake Russian accents. So he just thought it was easier to focus on the story and not have that confusing the situation. So in that series, you will see the uniform bland colours and actual uniforms that those under the Soviet Union wore. Appreciation of Vladimir Lenin, who young people called Dedushka Lenin, which means grandfather, was still taught in school. His body was still on display at the Kremlin, which it is today, even though times changed. The USA was evil and Russia was the greatest country on earth. The Soviet Union lay behind the Iron Curtain, and popular tourist countries like the Czech Republic and Hungary and even Poland weren't allowed to be visited. And as much as it probably annoys people, a number of years ago I read the biography of Roman Polanski, the director. He talked about how The Pianist, which is one of my favourite movies, was created. Many of the things in it was memories that he had from living in Poland. And when he got older, he tried to go to the West, and he would hide, you know, in the tops of trains, and he would be found and returned to Poland and under the Iron Curtain. Now, Katya, that's her name, sorry, she writes about receiving an exotic fruit as a gift from her grandmother when she was a child. And that exotic fruit was a banana. Her memories are mostly happy and at the tail end of the Soviet Union, and children in the Soviet Union were taught to pity those born in other countries, you know, like the West, the United States, the United Kingdom, even Australia. They didn't have a concept of what was on the outside, which is very similar to what's going on in North Korea. And I'm really trying to get into this because as I was writing it, I was thinking about how a lot of people really romanticize communism and socialism. And that's people who haven't studied it and don't have a grasp of it. They haven't traveled to countries that have partook in it. And I guess in a way, I'm trying to brainwash people as well in different episodes that I've done where we talk about communism. It was enforced grief, which is another thing in North Korea as well. In the USSR, you were expected to pretend to be sad for Communist Party members' deaths. That was expected. And atheism was the rule. There was no religion, which is a common, you know, trait of communism. Katia wrote for Forbes, quote, every fall we participated in a mandatory national military sports game called Zanitska, in which school children would play war games and learn basic field combat. During obligatory annual parades, each class was assigned a military division, dressed up in a corresponding uniform, sang military songs, and marched. The string of events was endless. We marched and sang on Great October Revolution Day, Young Anti-Fascist Day, Soviet Army and Navy Day, May Labor Day, Victory Day, Young Pioneer Day, the day Vladimir Lenin was born, the day he died, and so on. All of this marching took practice, so we marched at camp in the summertime and during school hours the rest of the year, occasionally gathering after school or on weekends, unquote. Now, during the Soviet Union rule, black and white TV that they were able to, some people would have a TV, many others wouldn't. It was state-run media, as were newspapers and all forms of media. So what you were being fed was what the government wanted you to believe, which I think is rearing its fucking ugly head these days. And there wasn't Disney. And as Katia said, you were not watching Mickey Mouse. You were watching, you know, child propaganda. People's living quarters were limited. Katia talks about how her family of five, including extended family members, would share one room. Now, what happened was during the Cold War, a lot of people's homes were reassigned and communism quality of life sucked. Now, I've been to the Czech Republic twice, and the second time I was lucky enough to travel with a friend of mine who I worked with in the UK, but his family was from the Czech Republic. Now, during our trip, it was the second time I'd been to Prague, which is my favorite city ever. We went to his auntie's house for dinner because he said we had to. It was part of, he has to do it every time he goes to the Czech Republic. Now, this woman was like she had lived under the Soviet era. She never smiled once during it. The minute we walked into her house, which was this beautiful apartment, she had like a drawn face. We walked immediately into her kitchen where we sat at a table. We ate food in silence. We then went into her sitting room. We had a cup of coffee. I tried to make conversation with her about like some of the art that she had on the walls. She didn't reciprocate. And then we left. Now, one of the things I was able to get out of her was I told her how beautiful her flat was, and it is in comparison to a lot of people's. But in Prague, most of the flats, including Alex's sister, who we stayed at her place, they're grey. And then parts of the city in Poland where I went, Poland, Prague, they're very colourful and you don't expect that under Soviet, you know, occupation. But Prague, all of the outsides were just grey. And she told me, when I told her it was a beautiful apartment, she said, this isn't our family's apartment. She told me that she goes, it was reassigned to them and the original family apartment was given to someone else. So that's what happens. And she was always kind of stewing on that. Now, the USSR, Soviet Union, the state provided everyone with homes, healthcare, cheap consumer goods, and basic food. And while modern communists or socialists believe that everyone can do this, this just isn't the case. The food that you're given is shit, like we were talking about with the exotic banana. Healthcare is very basic. As you'll see in Venezuela, people are literally just bleeding out in these dirty hospitals. That is pretty much socialist healthcare. And before you think that, yes, I'm from Australia and we have a form of socialized healthcare, it is not the same thing. Now, after graduation from university, education was free at the time. Everybody was given a job with a fixed salary where you worked for the state, you worked for the Soviet Union. And the fixed salary, which is really scary because it's something that I've seen a lot of countries discussing, which really angers me and it enrages me. It pretty much means that you just have an amount to live on. There's no way to get ahead. This is why capitalism is king, and this is why capitalism is the way life should be. Your future is very predictable. You get married, you have kids, you work for the state, and then you die. Citizens, as Katia said, went by the common saying, quote, pretended to work while the government pretended to pay them, unquote. Now, Katia talks about how they were dressed. Quote, in the living room on a dining table, my parents made dresses for me out of my dad's shirts, winter coats and duffel bags, as good merchandise was hard to find in Soviet stores. In the mid-1990s, when Western goods became available in Ukraine, neither of them touched a sewing machine again. Unquote. Now, laundry was done by hand. There was no washing machines. That is a luxury and was during the Soviet Union. I don't even think they would have known it would exist. And women, you'll enjoy this, didn't have access to pads or tampons, much like in you know, North Korea today. They used whatever they could find, which was pretty much cotton, wool or tissues that they were able to pretty much layer together. There wasn't Barbie. There were imported East German versions of dolls for kids to play with, and everything had propaganda behind it. Kids just couldn't just be kids. Katya said, quote, "The Soviet version of history omits many facts, the Holocaust, various famines, massacres, labor camps, mass executions, as well as this agreement between Stalin and Hitler," unquote. I think she was talking about the Treaty of Brest, I think. But basically, they're taught that nothing bad ever happened. Stalin never introduced collectivization. There were no famines. I think in the last century, I believe that 200 million people have died under communism. So if you think it works, think again. Katya said, quote, "My worst fear was nuclear war with the United States. Amid frequent nightmares about Americans bombing us, mixed with the earlier dreams about Nazis and World War II, I sang songs together with other young pioneers. Yes, yes, yes to the sunny world. No, no, no to a nuclear explosion. We were not allowed contact with the Western world, and very few Soviet citizens were permitted to go abroad, and those generally visited countries friendly with the Soviet Union. I did not meet a foreigner until I was 11, and even then, the foreigner was a gas station worker on a state-organized tour of Kharkiv from the communist Poland," unquote. Now, the Stasi, which is a term that's thrown around today with the way that police are acting, the Stasi were the Soviet Union's state secret police that operated from 1950 to 1990. And as I said, these days the term is thrown around to describe police, but it's nowhere near what the Stasi were like. The state police were paranoid. They thought everyone was the enemy, and they pretty much ruled the USSR as the state police with an iron fist. Now, I found an article in The Guardian from 2020 called "Enemies Everywhere. Photos Show Absurdity of Life Under the Soviet under the Stasi" by Philip Altman. This was from last year. He wrote, quote, "Over the 40-year existence of communist East Germany, the Ministry of State Security built one of the most tightly controlled surveillance regimes in history. The Stasi created a vast web of full-time agents and part-time spies, with some historians calculating that there was at least one informant for every 6.5 citizens," unquote. Now, if you remember, again, because it's probably the only thing I can kind of think of that's recent, the show Chernobyl, pretty much the Stasi were the ones that were watching Jared Harris's character in that. I can't think of what his name was, the main guy. He went on, quote, "In the 1950s, photography was still a relatively rare technology, but by the 80s, cameras were more widely available and the Stasi discovered them as what they called a weapon. The number of photographs taken grew exponentially. Cameras were hidden inside arm casts, shopping bags, books and bras, with the ministry offering incentives for employees who could come up with ingenious solutions," unquote. That made me think of Get Smart. I wonder if in some way they were kind of bagging the way they were operating them. Now, in 1976, Mikhail Gorbachev was moving the country towards a more liberalized kind of system where they were moving backwards from communism to socialism, because the steps are socialism to communism. He was working for a more market-oriented socialism, and he was really the first one to do that, and that's why a lot of people look back and hate Gorbachev. Mark got a souvenir when he was in Russia, and it's really cool. It's a Russian nesting doll, and each one is a different leader. So it's got Lenin, it's got Putin, it's got Gorbachev. And when he was telling me this funny story about when he bought it in Moscow, it's one of the coolest things ever because it's such a rare souvenir to have. He was saying that the guy was showing him the different nesting dolls within it, and he pretty much said, as they got to Gorbachev, "Gorbachev!" and like shook his fist like in the air. So people really don't look back at him fondly, a lot of people, even though he led them to, you know, become part of the Western world effectively. Now, Gorbachev, his changes actually led to further bread lines and product scarcity. People were barely able to get anything, which is what Navalny was talking about in that clip. And Katya, writing for Forbes, she remembered how her family would often travel from Ukraine to Moscow, which was about 500 kilometers, I believe, to get decent food. And when they were in Moscow, they would stay with an auntie of hers. So they would do this massive road trip to get actual food because it was available in the major cities. And she said that she saw Gorbachev as the devil. He was taking what they had worked for so many decades, almost a century. And he was basically giving Russia, in her opinion, and a lot of people's opinions who were really deep in the Communist Party, to the Western world. They'd been told forever that America especially was the devil. And now she felt that he was pretty much a devil, a traitor. But by 1990, communism was collapsing, due in part to changes that Mikhail Gorbachev had made. But also people were really starting to question the Communist Party. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989, which David Hasselhoff stood on it and sang. I was only two when that happened, but my parents remember it. And I think anyone present was just shocked that it came down. And schools at this point were barely teaching the Soviet ideology. They were using new textbooks to discuss, you know, not a propaganda version of history. Fierce supporters of the Communist Party were fearful as they felt that people were being de-brainwashed and people more and more were turning against the Communist Party. The Soviet Union was on the precipice of democracy, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and many people were really unhappy with that and fearful. Many people, because everyone was working in, you know, for the government, which is what happens in communism, they lost their jobs because state-run organizations weren't in operation anymore. So people had to go and actually find jobs, which is something that people weren't familiar with because you were just given it when you became of a certain age. Textbooks in schools changed and news started to trickle in from the rest of the world. And the first president of Russia, Russia as a country, was Boris Yeltsin, who I've told about, the dancing chubby guy. That's what I think of him as. Many did and still long for the days of the USSR. It meant certainty. It meant no matter how bleak, you know, you knew what was going to happen. It was expected. Your life was pretty much planned out for you. And capitalism meant the opposite. They really felt that no matter how bleak communism was, capitalism with all these options that people could make, where they could leave the country, where they could get their own jobs, was terrifying. Everything had been state provided, but it obviously came with a cost, which meant propaganda, brainwashing, no news from outside, the Stasi pretty much watching everybody. As that article said, they had one agent for every six people. So people knew that they were being watched no matter what. In this article, I found that even kids playing, the Stasi would come up to them because they would drop a ball and they would think that they were an enemy. It was insane. So back to Navalny. Alexei Navalny was 15 when life changed in the US, in the Soviet Union, and it was abolished. This is kind of an important time, I think, because he remembers earlier and he remembers his upbringing and how it was, but he's also old enough, you know, to know the history, but also to look at it from both sides. Many would say that life changed for the better, but many still dwell on it to this day, probably Navalny's parents, from what he said in that clip that I played you. His father came from near the border of Belarus, which is the capital of Ukraine, and his mother was Russian, and both were under the USSR. Navalny grew up in a village which was about 100 kilometers from Moscow, quite a small village, and I believe his parents still live there to this day, and they've never spoken publicly, and I often wonder what their opinion of him is, because he's kind of taken everything he was taught and shoved it back, like, in their faces. He kind of stands for the opposite of what his parents stood for. His parents were Anatoly Navalny and Ludmila Navalnaya. So remember that in these places, from my understanding, is they add like an A to the end of the woman's name. After the fall of the Soviet Union, his parents, who had obviously worked for state-run organizations, they founded a basket weaving factory, which is located in the village of Kobyakova, which is in today Ukraine. Moscow, which they have run since 1994, and it's still in operation today. In 1998, when he was 22 years old, Alexei graduated from the People's Friendship University of Russia, with a law degree. So by law, he's actually a lawyer. He then studied securities and exchanges at the Financial University under the government of the Russian Federation. And in 2010, he left Russia and actually went to the enemy's country, to the United States, and he went to Yale University, and he was in the Yale Fellows Program, World Fellows Program. Now, just 2 decades before, no one would have ever thought that people would be going on holidays or even expatriating or moving to the United States. Now, Navalny's never written a book, and all I can go off him is his interviews and things like that. I would love a book to be written about him. I've looked, but there's nothing. I think probably 10 people are working on one at the moment. But there's little in terms of him talking about his early days. So that's why the information I'm giving you is quite scarce. But I'd love for him to write a book. So now we're flashing forward to 2000, which is 9 years after the Soviet Union was officially abolished. There were elections for president, which were introduced, obviously, and many people believe that these are rigged. Depends on, you know, what you believe. Russia, by this point now, had a multi-party system. And as of last year, 2020, 6 parties have members in federal parliament. So in regards to Navalny, I'll be talking about a couple. Now, United Russia, who... it's really complicated and I've tried to get it into my head, but the setup of parliament is really boring to me. So United Russia, Vladimir Putin is an independent who is linked to United Russia. So that's why he is the president. United Russia is the largest party in Russia. It holds almost 75% of seats in the State Duma, which is the lower house. The Duma was set up after, you know, it was set up like a very long time ago because I was studying it when we were studying the Cold War. United Russia, which Putin is a member of, they have held that majority since 2007. Now, as I said, the Duma is the lower house, and this is what people are voted into. How boring is that government, really? Now, many people, including myself, Mark, we were talking about it a lot the other day, and Alexei Navalny and his supporters believe that elections are really just a facade and that voting is essentially rigged to appear as if the country is democratic when it's really not. So we're going to talk about Putin a little bit in the second episode. So back to 2000. What got Alexei Navalny into government was a new law was introduced that would, quote, raise the electoral threshold of the Duma, unquote. So I had to look this up, and this meant that it basically means that the minimum share of a primary vote for a candidate or party was raised. And this means they need this minority before they are entitled to any representation in the legislature. So it was raised to make it harder for parties that were not United Russia. So with this meaning that his opposition, which was he was a member, you know, of the Democrat Party, not of United Russia, this meant that he saw it as they had the law stacked against them. So Navalny took his first political steps and he joined the Russian Democratic Party, which is called Le Bloco. Now, at the time, he said he wasn't a fan of either opposition, United Russia or Le Bloco, but he decided to side with Le Bloco. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about term limits and elections in Russia, because I find this really interesting. And Mark and I had to look it up the other day. Now, this is how it works. Quote, the Constitution of Russia limits the election of one person to the presidency for 2 consecutive terms. Previously, the Constitution contains no ruling on a total number of terms that a president may serve. A former president could seek re-election after sitting out 1 complete term, unquote. Now, you'll see that it said previously the Constitution. So in 2020, the Constitution was allowed to be altered. And the way I see it is it was put to a national vote, which in Commonwealth countries, I don't know if it's just Australia, it's called a referendum where you vote for something to be changed. For instance, we voted for gay marriage. We voted for whether or not we wanted to maintain, be part of the monarchy. That was years ago before I was able to vote, and we voted yes to both. Now, in 2020, the Russian Constitution was altered to allow Vladimir Putin to run for 2 terms. So if you can see how long this man has been in, basically, this is very scary because it basically means he could be in until he dies. He effectively had the constitution altered. Now, whether or not you believe that people legitimately voted to allow him to continually run is another thing. But I'll get into how he's kind of worked, because I think we have to talk about Putin in order to talk about Navalny, because they're pretty much like arch nemesis of each other. But if you're interested, the next Russian election is in 2024, and I can already tell you who's going to get in. Now, in 2001, Navalny was officially listed as a member of the Democratic Party, Yabloko. And in 2002, he was elected to the regional council of the Moscow branch of Yabloko. And his star really started to rise very quickly at a very young age. He was only in his mid-20s at this time. In 2003, he headed the Moscow subdivision of the election campaign of the party, Yabloko, for the parliamentary election, which was held that year in December. And in 2004, he became chief of staff of the Moscow branch of Yabloko, and he maintained this position for 3 years. So this is a big jump for a guy who really wasn't a fan of either party. Also in 2004, Alexei Navalny became deputy chief of the Moscow branch of the Yabloko party. And from 2006 to 2007, he was a member of the Federal Council of the party. I'm not going into too much of this because most of the events leading up to the Navalny that the rest of the Western world knows now would happen, you know, in the last kind of 5-10 years. Little is known about kind of the relationship between Navalny and his wife, Yulia. I believe it's Yulia. You don't say Julia in Russia. But I follow Yulia on my private Instagram, and I'm a huge fan of her. And it's really an example, their relationship, of the saying behind every... Hang on. I've actually got a coaster with this written on. So I've got a coaster that my mother gave me when I was probably 10 that I have had all that time. It says, behind every successful woman is herself. So I think the actual saying is, behind every successful man is a strong woman, or something like that. And I think Yulia and Alexei's relationship is a really good example of that. But as a result of that, Yulia has faced so much criticism because how it's set up in Russia is still a very much patriarchal society. In the media there, she's painted as an overbearing wife and that she controls all of the choices. She's also been, you know, a stay-at-home mum for the last 20 years, so I don't think they have much respect for her. She did work and then she became a full-time mum and pretty much a secretary to Alexei. Alexei and Yulia are pretty much the same age, bar, I think, 4 months. Now, Alexei and Yulia met on a beach in Turkey in 1997, which was probably one of the earliest trips that either of them took out of the Soviet Union, because it was only 6 years after it was abolished. And Yulia's history, as much as she doesn't get much kind of interest in it, she's a really impressive woman. She had an economics degree and she's worked in some pretty like high up banks and positions. Now, one of the funniest things that I read when I was trying to learn a bit more about Yulia is that in Russian politics, women only make up 16% of the lower house of parliament to this day. And I don't know if that's because they don't go for the positions, because it's more of a patriarchal society, or because men get the majority of the vote. The roles that they are appointed to are really roles that they see women as being in charge of, like health or education. But actually, Russia has one of the largest gender imbalances in the world. In Russia, there's 11 more people, although their population is like a huge amount. Like there's 11 million more women than men in the population of Russia. This is because there's a high male mortality rate, which I don't understand. Maybe they kill their husbands. I don't know. Now, in 2020, there was a journalist who said that Yulia, her father, was working as the secretary of the Russian embassy in London. And as a result of that, which is not true, Alexei published a death certificate for Yulia's dad, which was dated 1996. So they make up a whole shitload of people. Facts. Now, Yulia and Alexei have 2 children who I'm not going to talk about too much in this because they really don't come into play a lot. I follow their daughter. Her name is Daria. She was born in 2001 and she actually goes to Stanford University. She's a very smart cookie. And I believe full time she lives in the USA. And I believe she's probably there permanently at the moment because it's very much not a safe place for the Navalny family to live. They have a son, Zakhar. He was born in 2008. Now, Yulia also joined Yabloko along with Alexei in the year 2000. And she left in 2011. She left the party. And today, most people consider her, quote, the first lady of the Russian opposition, unquote. Now, I'll get into this more probably on episode 3, but It's actually because of Yulia that we even know where Alexei is now. He's in a penal colony and they're having a lot of letters leaked from him, but they actually don't know how they're getting out, whether or not he has like an ally on the inside or what's happening. Yulia actually hasn't been able to see him for a couple of months since he was sentenced, and he's not very well at the moment. And that's why I really thought it was a good as time as any to do his story. Now, Yulia has more balls than most men combined. I often don't think of many women as having more balls than myself, but Yulia has way bigger balls than me. Now, Alexei Starr really began to shine in the Russian opposition. And in late 2006, he appealed to the Moscow City Hall asking for permission to conduct the Nationalist 2006 Russian March. Now, nationalist pretty much means the same thing in Russia that it means in the US. And he did say in this appeal for it to be granted that his party, Yabloko, condemned, quote, any ethnic or racial hatred and any xenophobia. And he called on the police to oppose, quote, any fascist, Nazi, xenophobic manifestations, unquote. So it's essentially like a white nationalist movement, which I think probably happens and exists in like every country. It's a very like xenophobic movement, and he got a huge amount of backlash for this that people still talk about today. Now, he maintains that he did it because he believes in freedom of speech. He believes, despite the fact that his beliefs aren't the same as these Russian nationalists, they believe in like ethnic cleansing and things like that. He still believes in the right to free speech, which is something that he and I have in common. So here's Alexei Navalny talking to the same 60 Minutes journalist about the Russian nationalist march, which got him in a whole load of shit.
Some of them fascists, something he's tried to downplay lately.
You have attended nationalist, what we would call right-wing rallies, I believe in support of ethnic purity, Russian ethnic purity. Have you supported that?
Of course not. I was part of these rallies because I support the freedom of rallies, because I support freedom for meetings.
Oh, they're supporters of yours. They're part of your following.
A lot of them supports me and they recognize me as a leader.
When he was growing up,
Now, from there, you can kind of understand what his platforms would become. He is against poverty, which he considers one of the main things facing Russians today. And he wants to reinstitute freedom of speech in Russia and freedom of the press, which is something that still does not exist. And I watched a really good documentary a number of years ago about one of the main newspapers in Russia and how most of the sub-editors, most of the senior editors have been murdered, and how it's extremely dangerous to be, you know, a liberal newspaper in Russia, which it still is today, which I think most people know. He wants to restore freedom of speech, freedom of association, and all the things that I think most people in the Western world, you know, like the United States, really don't realize how lucky they are to have that. In July 2007, after the rallies, Navalny ultimately resigned from his deputy chief of the Moscow branch of the Yabloko party post. He was then expelled from the Yabloko Democratic Party for demanding a resignation of the then chairman of the party, Grigory Yavlinsky. In 2007, Alexei Navalny co-founded the National Russian Liberation Movement, which goes by the term NAROD, which is kind of basically means the people. And this sets immigration policy as a major priority and one of the platforms that he stands on. Now, I understand that a lot of people don't understand that there needs to be immigration policy in the world. There needs to be a system which most of us, follow. And that is one of his platforms. Now, the problem was the movement then allied itself with two of the nationalist groups, which I talked about earlier, which is the Movement Against Illegal Immigration and the Great Russia. So that's where I'm going to leave it for the first part, because I really just wanted to talk about the history of Russia, Alexei Navalny's early years. From now on, we're going to be talking about how he really started to become a bit of a household name in Russia. Protests, the number of times he has been arrested, which is an astounding amount of times. And then we're going to talk about how he took on Putin, the oligarchs of Russia, and where it kind of stands at the moment, which I think we'll get into in part three. We'll talk about Alexei's poisoning with Novichok last August. him being taken to Germany for rehabilitation, coming back to Russia, and now being in a penal colony in Russia. So I hope that you guys are kind of enjoying something a little bit different. I think it's really important at the moment because it really astounds me how many people just kind of sit in front of the news and take in all this bullshit. Like, I know it's each to their own, but it really disturbs me how many people kind of follow what the Kardashians are doing. And these things are really important to hundreds of millions of people, like in Russia. This kind of determines how they're going to live, these actions. And it's led to major protests in Russia, which is kind of something that they didn't expect to see, how Alexei Navalny was able to be voted in. Basically, he got the second highest number of votes beside Putin, and how Putin really is very fearful of him, which a lot of people can see. And, you know, Navalny, he himself says, Putin never has once used Navalny's name, which is a sign of disrespect to people. And I think he's very fearful of him. So I'll be back in a couple of days, maybe Easter Sunday or Monday, with the next part where we'll talk about Navalny, you know, becoming quite a hostile figure. And go to the website at unknownpassagepodcast.com. I'll put up a Navalny page, you know, during this series at some point. Become a patron at unknownpassagepodcast.com/patron. It links off the website, but you can also just download the Patreon app. And we're getting a lot of patrons, which is fucking awesome. And we have a really like respectful community, which is awesome, which is what I was trying to do by removing myself off Instagram. And it's so liberating. I fucking love it, and more people should do it. I've also set up if you don't want to become a patron, but you want to contribute, I've set up a PayPal, which is unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. It's just our website. So you can just send money directly through PayPal. And yeah, I think that's it. Leave a 5-star review if you like the show. I've had so many nice reviews lately where people actually are like, understand the level of research I put in, which is one of the reasons why I set up this podcast. I love people sharing their stories. I had one recently about from a patron who's a new patron who they're just their experiences traveling across the world. I just love hearing your stories. And yeah, I just like people who take this stuff seriously and don't think it's like a comedy, which I was thinking about it yesterday again, because I don't listen to a lot of true crime podcasts anymore that consider themselves comedy ones. I don't enjoy ones where people are drinking cocktails while talking about this shit. This affects people's lives. It affects the rest of their lives. People who I've covered who their children have gone missing, it's their entire life, it's gutted them. And then someone comes along who makes a joke of it and drinks a fucking martini while talking about it. And no offense if that's how you want to live your life, but that's not how I fucking want to leave any kind of legacy for mine. So yeah, I love you all, and I'll be back in a couple of days. Enjoy Easter, eat chocolate, eat food. I had one. My stepmother gave me one when I went to visit my dad and her a couple of weeks ago. I put her in the bottom of my, I called the Easter Bunny her. I put it in the bottom of my bag, and it was like a 35 degree day. It was completely melted, smashed to oblivion, and then molded together again. And I still ate it. So I'll talk to you then. Bye.